Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. And all the stations that syndicate this program and all the people around the world listening. This is going to be an empowering hour. As always, we begin with the latest on health and healing. Something new about broccoli. Also, Fordham University is experiencing a mumps outbreak among vaccinated. A discovery of a new MRSA strain in milk. Exciting implications for knee joints. Glucosamine plus chondroitin can reduce joint space narrowing. That's good if you have that condition. A lot of people do. And a lot more on health and healing. Then we go to our commentary section of the program. And today, more than normal. For example, this will be open for discussion, and I'll be asking you after you hear it to call in and share your points of view. I'll be giving that early on, and then you'll have a talkback segment. This was sent to me by Stephen Brown, and it talked about one judge, a U.S. District Judge, Miles Lord, who held officers of A.H. Robbins Company personally liable for the injuries caused by the interuterine contraption called the Dalcon Shield, and 18 women died, 300,000 were injured. I'll go into that in detail, and then you'll have a chance to call in when I ask the question, share your points of view. Also, when traveling around the United States, just filming out at Berkeley last week, I ask a common question. You're here at an important university, an activist university. Why isn't there any real student-wide protest against, and then I list any one of 50 topics that they legitimately could be protesting, not the least of which is the usurious interest rates on their loans, the fact they can't get out of those loans, the fact that they could be arrested by a SWAT team in California, the fact there's debtors' prisons. None of that is being protested. Well, Alexandria McGee in Counterpunch responds to it. University of California, Berkeley, and the myth of the activist life, the myth of it. Also today, a commentary by Chris Hedges. Moral courage, what it takes to be a free country. Also today from Robert Burroughs, from Nation of Change, why do we fear the truth? Also, the most damaging pill in America. And new research they've just done out at Berkeley shows very high levels of cesium radioactivity in the roadside. So we have a lot to talk about, plus something unique and exclusive today. We want to commend Dr. Brian Hooker. He is a highly respected biochemist and scientist. He did what no one else has been able to do. He got the truth. And today, in our public health segment, you'll hear the truth. It took them years, 100 different Freedom of Information Act requests, but they finally got the truth out of the CDC. So you're going to hear it first on this program today. Let's begin. Millions of Americans suffer from various forms of inflammation in the joint, and that can cause all forms of swelling and joint problems. There's a new study that shows that 1,500 milligrams of glucosamine sulfate and 800 milligrams of chondroitin sulfate resulted in a statistically significant decrease in joint space narrowing versus a placebo. Quote, this was an investigator-initiated, rigorously conducted, randomized clinical trial. Two-year follow-up was excellent. The active treatment capsules were independently tested to ensure appropriate content of glucosamine and chondroitin. The demonstrated benefit in terms of disease modification may simply be due to achieving a biologically meaningful dose with a combined treatment, a dosage that is not achieved using the glucosamine or chondroitin alone. Produce these results. So what does this show? This was published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. And there was a separate article in the International Journal of Rheumatic Disease. Here's what it is. University of Sydney in Australia. They looked at a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, long-term evaluation of glucosamine sulfate and glucosamine sulfate together. And it was the use of these together that resulted in these major improvements. So for those of you who have knee problems, swelling, inflammation, loss of cartilage, and before you get a knee replacement, you can try this. Now, I know there are a lot of supplements on the market that use them separately. Use them together, glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate. And that's mainstream science in a major study in a major peer-reviewed journal telling it works. We know that broccoli's good. How good? Well, according to the University of Illinois College of Agriculture, a very important concept of eating garlic is that you can get enhanced anti-cancer benefits. So what they're doing is that we've known for at least a dozen years that when you eat broccoli or broccoli sprouts, you're getting anti-cancer properties. Now they're coming up with a way to crossbreed these naturally to get even higher anti-cancer activity in broccoli. Quote, we had to figure out ways to increase the anti-cancer activity in broccoli, but the way we figured out, it created a situation that would cause the product to deteriorate more rapidly after application. For fresh market broccoli that you harvest, it's not too big a deal, but many of these products have to be shipped, frozen, cut up, or put into the products, and they figured out a way of doing it with a non-toxic plant signaling compound produced naturally in plants to increase the broccoli's anti-cancer potential, and which they sprayed on the broccoli for about 4 days before harvest, and it increased the anti-cancer property substantially, and that's good. So what has happened first, just understand the significance of this. What has happened first is that first they had to determine broccoli has anti-cancer properties. That's really important. Then, after recognizing with all these studies, many, many studies, that broccoli and broccoli sprouts can help prevent cancer if you have cancer, could be used to treat it, they want to get more of this potent cancer preventative agent into your body. Because the what are called glucosinolates have been identified as potent cancer preventative agents. Why? Because they induce detoxification enzymes, such as what is called quinine reductase, that detoxifies and eliminates carcinogens from the human body. So when you eat a lot of broccoli or broccoli sprouts, or you even juice broccoli, though that's kind of hard to do, you don't get very much juice. I suggest you do it simply. I suggest you steam the broccoli lightly. That opens up the cell, the oligocellulose, allowing all of the indole-3 carbonyl chemicals, all the natural chemicals that are good for you, to be released into your body. Then blanch it. Run cold water over it for about 30 seconds. Then marinate it in a wonderful mustard olive oil sauce or horseradish sauerkraut sauce, and then use that in a salad. For those of you who like fermented foods, you're getting the benefit of the probiotics with the sauerkraut. And horseradish is one of nature's most powerful antiviral antibacterial agents. And mustard is also, the mustard seed is a very powerful healing agent. So this way you get your broccoli in a way that's palatable, and you get plenty of it, and it's ready to digest immediately. So then you're able to go in the body and stimulate the natural detoxification process. From Fordham University, this is according to WABC, quote, Fordham University is working to contain a mumps outbreak at its campus, and it found that all the people who got the mumps were all vaccinated. Well, hold on a second. If you were vaccinated for preventing the mumps, and then you got the mumps, that means the vaccine didn't work. Hopefully, someone will pay attention to that. From the Lancet Infectious Disease Journal, University of Cambridge Veterinary School in Great Britain, It's published in Medical News. A new strain of methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or MRSA, has been discovered by scientists, and the new strain has been identified in milk. And so, one more reason not to drink the milk. Green tea, some really good health benefits here, including on autoimmune disease. Now, this is from Oregon State University, and it's published in Immunology Letters. Quote, one of the beneficial compounds found in green tea has a powerful ability to increase the number of regulatory T cells that play a key role in immune function and suppression of autoimmune disease. This may be one of the underlying mechanisms for the health benefits of green tea. And so, quote, this appears to be a natural plant-derived compound that can affect the number of regulatory T cells and in the process improve immune function. This was according to the Oregon State University Department of Nutrition and Exercise Sciences. Now, let me just think. Let's go back for a moment. Let's go back to 1970 when in fast-track heterosexuals, and the group that was selected were partying all the time at Plato's Retreat and some other swingers clubs. But there were a lot of people in those clubs. But there was one hardcore group. These were people that wanted to party all night, all the time. And the way they were able to do that is they were able to use amyl nitrate. You put it under your nose, you crack it, and boom, you get this instantaneous euphoria. And it's a sexual euphoria. It was also being used in a lot of the bathhouses after the sexual revolution within the gay community. But again, a tiny fraction of all gays participated in the hardcore part of it, the fast trackers. These were the people that really went out every night, party. Now, partying every night is not going to hurt you. Having sex doesn't hurt you. But when you're drinking alcohol, smoking cigarettes, staying up all night, using amyl nitrate, ecstasy, having unprotected anal intercourse, then that can kill you, whether you're heterosexual or you're fast-track gay. Now, only a tiny percentage of the heterosexuals participated in the sexual revolution, as is also true for the gays. And we just think more people did because we put so much attention and media focus on it. But the majority of the people were not participating. And I was fortunate enough that I was doing the research to see who I could help within both groups. And I was working with both. I was working with a leading gay physician, Dr. Stephen Kaiza, who had a huge practice within the gay community, and he couldn't help some of these people. And he would call me and say, Gary, I got, you know, these people, and they have all the similar symptoms. Can you help? And so I'd put them on a detox protocol. I would give them probiotics about five times a day because their guts were a mess and their T cells were low, their immune system was low, and they were getting thrush, they were getting candida, some in their lungs. And I also saw the same identical thing in heterosexuals. You see, no one ever to this day, no one's ever paid attention to the fact that you had AIDS-defining illnesses before AIDS was identified in the heterosexual community. You'd see the couples that'd be sitting in my office, they would have had multiple cases of herpes 1, 2, 6, hepatitis, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and their immune systems would be shot. They'd be suffering with flu-like symptoms and chronic diarrhea. And the same thing within this group. This is before AIDS, right? Before AIDS. All of them got the same identical protocol, and all of them who stuck with it benefited and made some major progress. Now, here's what most people are not aware of. At that time, I didn't know there was such a thing, but there was a New York Gay Vegetarian Society, and it had a lot of people. They asked me to come and lecture. I did, and the place was just packed. I don't know how many people were there. I have to guess 1,000 people. And when I asked how many of you have an active sex life, hands went up. And I said, how many of you have diseases? Very few hands went up. And then when I found out how healthy they were, well, having sex is a healthy process of living. It depends upon if you're having safe sex and happy sex, along with it, just having sex. But later, I would ask the healthy gays to counsel and help with the lifestyle behavior modification of the fast tracks who were trying to get their health back. And it was very, very substantive. It worked. And a lot of people today are alive and well because they changed their lifestyle. They recreated a whole new sense of immune competence. The same is true within the heterosexual community. Both were virtually identical in all the symptoms they manifested. But one key thing all of them were taking, they were taking some really strong preparations, including bitter melon juice each day and bromelain, where they'd have to juice about 20 of the stems of pineapple and just drink that. It wasn't easy to get much liquid out of it because it's very dry and pithy, but they would make it into smoothies and drink it. But green tea was sometimes taken 6 times a day, every day. And now, from this study, we're seeing, quote, the green tea is able to increase the number of regulatory T cells. So now when we saw those T cells starting to climb and people had almost none, up into the hundreds, even 1,000, 1,500 with Louis, one of the people I was working with, now we know why, one of the reasons why. And it also helped overcome autoimmune conditions. And when you have a chronically exposed body to foreign agents, you're going to have autoimmune reactions. So now we have the science to support why so many people got well with immune modulating programs. Also, vitamin E tocotrienols significantly lower the disease-promoting triglycerides. Now, a lot of people don't realize when you have elevated triglycerides how dangerous that is. It is. But most people don't take tocotrienols. Toco, T-O-C-O, tri, T-R-I-E, nols, N-O-L-S. These are very important to consume on a daily basis. Now, this was reported in the Journal of Atherosclerosis and Thrombosis, and they found that the full-spectrum vitamin E tocotrienols used for 30 days decreased the artery-clogging triglycerides by 28%. And that's so important. And triglycerides are generated in your liver in response to a diet generally high in carbohydrate and hydrogenated or trans fats. And they accumulate in organs around the body, especially your cardiac muscle, where they influence the expression of genes that promote coronary artery disease. So quite simply, if you have high triglycerides, that leads to an aggravated accumulation of blood platelets, and we know those blood platelets can create clots, and those clots can cause a heart attack or stroke. So bringing down your triglycerides is essential to being healthy, and that is important. So the full spectrum tocotrienols each day makes a difference. Also, men. Common painkillers kill orgasms in men. This is from Boston University School of Medicine. It's very important that you realize you're taking painkillers, then you're going to really cut into having an orgasm. This is published in the American Journal of Geriatric Pharmacology. If you've got pain, fine, then deal with that pain using natural pain relief. And we've gone through that extensively. And also, by the way, I want to re-mention that up on my website, I put a vegan food pyramid. In other words, how many servings of the different groups of foods you have in a day, and to be all ideally healthy. And so you can go there, and this way you're not ignorant about what you should be taking each day. Women, important magnesium supplements may ease hot flashes for breast cancer patients. This was published in Supportive Care in Cancer. 400 milligrams per day of magnesium for 4 weeks showed a 41% reduction in the frequency of hot flashes. Quote, Oral magnesium appears to have helped more than half of the patients and was well tolerated. And it cost pennies to do this. This was a randomized placebo double-blind control trial. I would suggest doubling that, 800 milligrams a day, and watch the hot flashes come down. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. I always like to bring you the cutting-edge material, especially when those of us in the field have been hammered relentlessly by pro-industry groups that are disguised as consumer groups or the completely discredited quackbusters. And by the way, the quackbusters are about to get hammered in a major lawsuit. They've lost six out of the six last lawsuits, and according to one of the transcripts we got, they were discredited as expert witnesses, and yet they're very smart, and the pharmaceutical companies behind them, that's how they get such high ratings on the website. Well, one of the things we've been saying is that there's an association between the number and type of vaccines and the ingredients and adjuvants in those vaccines and neurological damage. That is irrefutable. In fact, so overwhelming is the evidence that I brought together some of the world's leading toxicologists and immunologists and vaccinologists to prove it. And we did a film that many of you saw. 1,000 people were at the premiere at the Ethical Culture Center recently for the silent epidemic. This is the latest, and this was that very important piece that we were looking for. Now it shows everyone in the vaccine challenge field, you were right. Everyone and all their apologists were wrong. And we owe one man this credit. It wasn't vaccination. It was Brian Hooker. Quote, for nearly 10 years, Brian Hooker, PhD, has been requesting documents that are kept under tight wraps by the CDC. His more than 100 Freedom of Information Act requests have resulted in copious evidence that the vaccine preservative thimerosal, which is still used in the flu shot that is administered to pregnant women and infants, can cause autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders. Dr. Hooker, a PhD scientist, worked with two members of Congress to craft the letter to the CDC that recently resulted in his obtaining long-awaited data from the CDC, the significance of which is historic. According to Dr. Hooker, the data on over 400,000 infants born between 1991 and 1997, which were analyzed by the CDC epidemiologist Thomas Verstraeten, MD, quote, proves unequivocally that in 2000, CDC officials were informed internally of the very high risks of autism, non-organic sleep disorders, and speech disorder associated with thimerosal exposure, end quote. When the results of the Verstraeten study were first reported outside the CDC in 2005, there was no evidence that anyone but Dr. Verstraeten within the CDC had known of the very high 760% relative risk of autism from exposure to thimerosal during pregnancy and infancy. Well, but now clear evidence exists. A newly acquired abstract from 1999. Now write this down. It's entitled Increased Risk of Developmental Neurologic Impairment After High Exposure to Thimerosal-Containing Vaccine in First Month of Life, end quote. Again, this is from the CDC's own secret articles that they've hidden from the public that was finally gotten because of two members of Congress. Quote, increased risk of developmental neurologic impairment after high exposure to thimerosal-containing vaccine in first month of life, end quote, required the approval of top CDC officials prior to his presentation at the Epidemic Intelligence Service Conference. Thimerosal, which is 50% mercury by weight, was used in most childhood vaccines at that time. The CDC maintains there is, quote, no relationship between thimerosal-containing vaccines and autism raised in children, even though the data from the CDC's own Vaccine Safety Data Link database shows a very high risk. There are a number of public records to back this up, including the congressional record of May 1, 2003. The CDC's refusal to acknowledge thimerosal's risk is exemplified by a leaked statement by Dr. Maria McCormick, chairman of the CDC National Institute of Health-sponsored Immunization Safety Review, regarding vaccinations. She said in 2001, quote, "We are not ever going to come down that it is autism is a true side effect," end quote. Mind you, she said this. Listen again to what the head of this said. This is a cover-up. Quote, "We are not ever going to come down that it is autism is a true side effect of the vaccines." Also of note, the former director of the CDC, which purchases $4 billion worth of vaccines annually, is now, you guessed it, president of Merck's vaccine division. Dr. Hooker's fervent hope for the future is that we've got to ensure that this and other evidence of the CDC malfeasance are presented to Congress and the public as quickly as possible. Time is the essence. Children's future is at stake. A divide within the autism community has led to some activists demanding that compensation of those with vaccine-injured claims be top priority before Congress. Dr. Hooker maintains that prevention, protecting our most precious resource, children's minds, must come first. I believe that both are correct. Referring to an organization that has seen its share of controversy this past year, Dr. Hooker remarked, quote, "It is unfortunate that Safe Minds," let me repeat that, "that Safe Minds issued a press release of my information, is accepting credit for my work and has not supported a worldwide ban on thimerosal," end quote. Well, this was Dr. Hooker, no one else. He did it. It's to him that we should say thank you. 15 years experience in the field of bioengineering and also an associate professor at Simpson University specializing in biology and chemistry. And he has published over 50 peer-reviewed scientific and engineering papers. So he's given us the truth. Now we have it. So what does this mean? It means that all these years the CDC has been lying, has been deceiving us. I believe that all of us in this audience should contact our legislators and demand that public hearings where Dr. Hooker and Robert Kennedy Jr., because they both have information that could show that the CDC has been lying, because it was Robert F. Kennedy Jr. who, through the Freedom of Information Act, got the Simpsonwood papers that showed that they knew of a connection at that time. Well, now we have the absolute internal documents. So there is no longer any legitimacy in any of the pro-vaccine medical doctors saying, oh, there's no connection. And so we have the truth on our side. Now we need to get those who were responsible for the cover-up before Congress under oath and hold them accountable. That's what we need to do. This is historic. And could you imagine how long it's taken for all this information to get into our hands? But now it's there. So we're going to go forward, and we're going to demand hearings. We have at least 50 scientists, professors, PhDs, myself included, that will go before Congress and testify about what we know on vaccines. Richard Gale, one of our scholars in residence, and myself have published 28 separate scholarly reports on the dangers of vaccines and the lack of safety and efficacy. Those are all on GaryNall.com. You can read them, plus 3 multi-award-winning films on vaccines, Vaccine Nation, Autism Made in the USA, and now the newest one, The Silent Epidemic. So in time, the truth will come out. Hopefully sooner rather than later. Now for our question to this audience. I have 2. One is about what this judge did, and should we not be demanding this today? This is from Stephen Brown. Quote, "I had forgotten the seldom followed legal principle applied by the courts in the Dalcon Shield case of 1968. Which punished corporate executives personally for the criminal behavior of their company. I've always said it is unjust and useless to fine corporations for criminal behavior because corporations don't commit crimes. Corporate executives do. By fining a corporation, the innocent stockholders are punished while the actual criminal executives are allowed to go free and usually keep their jobs, as in the cases of massive criminal fraud committed by bankers and chief financial executives during the recent financial crisis. This summary of the Dowcon Shield case came from a very good site that keeps a calendar of important civil rights victories updated. It's called peacebuttons.info. By the way, I'm really familiar with this because I help work on promoting the dangers of the Dowcon Shields and use my earlier radio shows on a regular basis to go after these people. Quote, this is from February 29, 1968. U.S. District Judge Miles W. Lord held the officers of A.H. Robbins Company personally liable for the injuries caused by the contraceptive device they had produced and sold, the Dowcon Shield. 18 women had died, more than 300,000 ultimately claimed injury. The top three executives had to pay $4.6 million personally, and the company paid out $220 million in compensatory and $13 million in punitive damages to thousands of women. Judge Lord said, the whole cost-benefit analysis is warped. They say, well, you can kill so many people if the benefits are great enough. Once they put a price on human life, all is lost. Life is sacred. Life is priceless. End quote. He also criticized Robbins' legal strategy of requiring witnesses to discuss their sexual lives. Quote, you expose these women and ruin their families and reputations and careers in order to intimidate those who would raise their voices against you. You introduced issues that had no relationship whatsoever to the fact that you implanted in the bodies of these women instruments of death, mutilation, and disease. End quote. Judge Lord was called before a review panel of his professional and judicial conduct, appears in the case, but the charges were dismissed, and he continued to serve until retirement. Now, could you imagine if we held every officer who was complicit in allowing any dangerous vaccine or medication or anything else to go into the community? Could you imagine if we held everyone on Wall Street, of every financial house, who knew about and supported and approved of all of the fraudulent loans and all of the gaming of the system, where we put them in jail or fine them? What would the world be like today? I'm Gary Knoll, and now to a commentary from Chris Hedges, from Truthdig. I really thought this was important, and I'd like your feedback. Quote, I have been to war. I have seen physical courage. But this kind of courage is not moral courage. Very few of even the bravest warriors have moral courage. For moral courage means to defy the crowd, to stand up as a solitary individual, to shun the intoxicating embrace of comradeship, to be disobedient to authority, even at the risk of your life, for a higher principle. And with moral courage comes persecution. The American Army pilot, Hugh Thompson, had moral courage. He landed his helicopter between a platoon of U.S. soldiers and 10 terrified Vietnamese civilians during the My Lai massacre. He ordered his gunner to fire his M60 machine gun on the advancing U.S. soldiers if they began to shoot the villagers. And for this act of moral courage, Thompson, like Snowden, was hounded and reviled. Moral courage always looks like this. It is always defined by the state as treason. The army attempted to cover up the massacre and court-martial Thompson. It is the courage to act and to speak the truth. Thompson had it. Daniel Ellsberg had it. Martin Luther King had it. What those in authority once said about them, they say today about Snowden. My country, right or wrong, is the moral equivalent of my mother, drunk or sober. So said G.K. Chesterton. So let me speak to you about those drunk with the power to sweep up all your email correspondence, your tweets, your web searches, your phone records, your file transfers, your live chats, your financial data, your medical data, your criminal or civil court records, and your movements. Those who are awash in billions upon billions of taxpayer dollars, those who have banks of sophisticated computer systems along with biosensors, scanners, face recognition technologies, and miniature drones, those who have obliterated your personal life, your privacy, and yes, your liberty. There is no free press without the ability of the reporters to protect the confidentiality of those who have the moral courage to make public the abuse of power. Those few individuals inside government who dare to speak out about this system of mass surveillance have been charged as spies or hounded into exile. An omnipresent surveillance state, and I cover the East German Stasi state, creates a climate of paranoia and fear. It makes democratic dissent impossible. Any state that has the ability to inflict full-spectrum dominance on its citizens is not a free state. It does not matter if it does not use this capacity today. It will use it, history has shown, should it feel threatened or seek greater control. The goal of wholesale surveillance, as Hannah Arendt wrote, is not in the end to discover crimes, but, quote, to be on the hand when the government decides to arrest a certain category of the population. The relationship between those who are constantly watched and tracked and those who watch and track them is the relationship between masters and slaves. Those who wield this unchecked power become delusional. General Keith Alexander, the director of the National Security Agency, hired a Hollywood set designer to turn his command center at Fort Meade into a replica of the bridge of the Starship Enterprise so he could sit in the captain's chair and pretend that he was Jean-Luc Picard. James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, had the audacity to lie under oath to Congress. This spectacle was a rare glimpse into the absurdist theater that now characterizes America's political life. A congressional oversight committee holds public hearings. It is lied to. It knows it's being lied to. The person who lies knows the committee members know he's lying, and the committee to protect their security clearances say and does nothing. These voyeurs listen to everyone and everything. They bugged the conclave that elected the new pope. They bug the German chancellor, Miss Merkel. They bug most of the leaders of Europe. They intercepted the talking points of UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon ahead of a meeting with President Obama. Perhaps the esteemed opposition can enlighten us to the security threats posed by the conclave of the Catholic cardinals, the German chancellor, and the UN Secretary General. They bug businesses like the Brazilian oil company and American law firms engaged in trade deals with Indochina for shrimp and clove cigarettes. They carried out a major eavesdropping effort focused on the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Bali in 2007. They bugged their ex-lovers, their wives, and their girlfriends. And the National Security Agency stories, our data stores it in perpetuity. I was a plaintiff before the Supreme Court in a case that challenged the warrantless wiretapping, a case dismissed because the court believed the government's assertion that our concern about surveillance was speculation. We had, the court said, no standing, no right to bring the case, and we had no way to challenge this assertion, which we now know to be a lie, until Snowden. In the United States, the Fourth Amendment limits the state's ability to search and seize to a specific place, time, and event approved by a magistrate, and it is impossible to square the bluntness of the Fourth Amendment with the arbitrary search and seizure of all of our personal communications. Former Vice President Al Gore said correctly that Snowden disclosed evidence of crimes against the United States Constitution. We who have been fighting against mass state surveillance for years, including my friend Bill Biney within the National Security Agency, made no headway by appealing to the traditional centers of power. It was only after Snowden methodically leaked documents that disclosed crimes committed by the state that genuine public debate began. Elected officials, for the first time, promised reform. The president, who had previously dismissed our questions about the extent of state surveillance by insisting there was strict congressional and judicial oversight, appointed a panel to review intelligence. Three judges have, since the Snowden revelation, ruled on the mass surveillance, with two saying the National Security Agency spying was unconstitutional and a third backing it. None of this would have happened, none of it, without Snowden. Snowden had access to the full roster of everyone working in the National Security Agency. He could have made public the entire intelligence community and undercover assets worldwide. He could have exposed the locations of every clandestine station in their missions. He could have shut down the surveillance system, as he has said, in an afternoon. But this was never his intention. He wanted only to halt the wholesale surveillance, which, until he documented it, was being carried out without consent or knowledge. No doubt, we will hear from the opposition of all the ways Snowden should have made his grievances heard. But I can tell you from personal experience, as can Bill, that this argument is as cogent as the author made by the March Hare during the Mad Tea Party in Alice in Wonderland. End quote, and that's, I think, very, very important insight into what is occurring with the national security state. From Chris Hedges. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come back with your questions, concerns, issues on TalkBack. And then I'm also going to share this insight on why do we fear the truth, as well as, well, you go to Berkeley. Wow, that's a good activist center. Not. Stay with us. Back in a moment. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Let's say hello to Ken from New Jersey. Hi, Ken. Your turn.
No, it's Tim, Gary.
Okay, Tim.
How are you doing?
Doing great, thank you.
Good, good. You were mentioning about the judge. The charges were dismissed in that instance, because when the judge actually ruled against the corporate executives.
I was not aware of that.
I thought that was what you said.
No. What happened was the judge held the executives who were responsible for making the decisions about the Dowcon Shield personally liable and fined them over $4 million at that time. That would be almost $12 million, $15 million today or more. So they were held personally liable. Today, no one is held personally liable. The corporation...
Oh, so that's what it should be for all of them. That would be actual justice.
I agree.
It turns out that the one other thing, the that sea salt, the pink Himalayan sea salt, that francium is of no concern of harm or danger whatsoever. It has a very it's very unstable, and it just has no it breaks down to an inert form almost instantly, so it isn't really a concern, and everything else in there is perfectly fine.
Thanks. Appreciate you sharing that with us. Now, this is from Alexandria McGee. On February 13, 2014, I attended University of Berkeley protests against the appointment of Janet Napolitano as president of the University of California system. The qualms against her appointment fall outside of my purview to describe here. But this is much larger than Napolitano or the protest itself. Instead, let's look at how systemic economic inequality has affected the mentality and thereby the capability for action of my generation. Organized by the Associated Students of the University of California, the protest attracted upwards of 500 people. And with protest signs, clothed banners, megaphones, and fists of solidarity, this crowd of young students had been protesting since 10 a.m. I started asking onlookers what their motivations were for being there and what they thought of the movement until I realized this was no real protest. Napolitano was in the Dia Hall. Protesters had taken their nearby Bloom Center for developing economies. We stood fist held high and shouting into a megaphone, all pointed in the opposite direction from our supposed target. The hall where Napolitano was inconveniently guarded with five large men guarding the bottom entrance, doors locked on the second floor, three cops with shiny sunglasses glaring down at us from the roof, and two cops on bikes circling the building. News reporters stood outside, pointing their video camera into the disjointed group, many of whom were unaware of what our strategy was or what we demanded here. "Why aren't we occupying that hall?" I began to ask those around me. And they emphasized they were, quote, not going to negotiate with Napolitano on the issue of her resignation, end quote. But how would occupying a nearby building do anything at all? Why are we not engaging in constructive dialogue? Well, but how will our chanting together do anything but stroke our own egos? But this is Berkeley. Radicals? All of us? Pure ideological masturbation, unless we do something provocative to cause change. I am frustrated that Berkeley continues to perpetuate the myth of its activist lifestyle for economic gain. It sells an image of the rebel protester, the ideological martyr, to a generation of youth that cannot find their way four blocks north without a GPS device. Never mind find their way past the bureaucratic labyrinth to create substantial change. With their tuition and the gradual privatization of education, they perpetuate the inequality of wealth and even endorse human rights abusers, as they have been allowing Napolitano to do by their system president. If Mario Savio were amongst us, he would hang his head in absolute shame, not just at the cafe on campus toting his name as a publicity stunt, but our failure to question the status quo, to disturb the system. You don't occupy a building which poses no strategical advantage. You don't chant just to hear make yourself feel good. And you don't boast that you're creating community when really all you're doing is attracting people who want to update their Facebooks with a new rebel profile picture. This frustration is also fueled by great hope that I once had in the Occupy movement. Surrounded by well-intentioned, intelligent people, I was sure that change was in our grasp. But we were outlasted in our patience, overcome by our fragmentation, and overconfident in our abilities. Now, I was ready to rush the police to occupy a space of power for those who couldn't, to represent those who had been deported from their country because Napolitano's indiscriminate nature and policies, to recognize our own humanity in a space where we would not be welcomed, to demand recognition and respect as a human rather than as an authoritative citizen, authorized also as a citizen. But doing so would require facing down strong men of the establishment. To do so would put in jeopardy our clean police records with some nonsense charge of noncompliance. As a fellow protester said, she worried that if we actually tried to change something, she wouldn't be able to get a job because it would show up on her record. She didn't actually think anything would change. Bullseye, compliance to capitalism fueled by fear. The threat of economic punishment if we are labeled as radical. The revolution will not come through those who are merely surviving. To squash the potential for social change, create a climate of such drastic inequality that people become self-paralyzed by their own fear. Render them helpless with the threat of poverty. Entertain them with mindless content to distract them from critically thinking about changing society, and you have a population you can manipulate and control into governable, well-behaved, self-regulated, obedient proletariat. To have successful messages sent to the establishment that we were serious about this change would have required taking the hall. By not doing so, it was as if the protests were sending the message, "We are here to work within the parameters of our permitted protest, structurally delegitimizing any possibility of actual change. Take your radical theory elsewhere." This is not radical. Berkeley students are sold on the idea that they will be challenging the inequalities of our generation. But I've never met people here with such rigid thought patterns, a lack of critical theory or action. To see such conformity, docility, and fear in my fellow students was enraging. From the persons taking selfies, from others like me with their heads low, and from smirking policemen, I walked away with one thought in my mind. The system in place sublimely manipulates our social reality in ways obvious only when we realize that there's nothing between us and the police but fear, error, and opportunity. Why do we hesitate? Why have we grown so fearful? Are we just scared that we will ruin our economic chances of success if we take a social stand? Have we sacrificed the potential for community and solidarity to the gods of hyper-individualistic profit? I'm just as bad as they are. I left to write. How will these words demand to be recognized, demand the power they deserve in order to chip away at the inequalities of our modern system? I'm not sure. I'm just as bad as they are. End quote, Alexandria McGee, a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley. I'm Gary Nall. We're going back to our talk back, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. If you'd like to call in, please do so. We'll be happy to hear what you have to say. Let's say hello to Edward from... Where are you from, Edward?
I'm Wyckoff.
Wyckoff where?
NJ.
Okay. How can I help you?
Have you done or have you considered a study on breatharianism and the use of pranic energy?
I have not done a study, and the one advocate about 20 years ago of breatharianism was a guru down in the woods of Pennsylvania. The trouble is he was shown late at night going to a fast food restaurant, loading up on meals, then telling people he was existing on breathing. There is no basis to being able to survive on just air. That's unfortunate, but that's one of those urban legends that continues to persist in those who are not aware of the truth of it. Thanks for your call. Let's go over and say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I got an email that mentions my name.
Good.
Yeah, I don't have a name here, but she says, I've been listening to Luann, and I was motivated by what she says. And she says, I'm now 57, and I think I want to try and compete in sports. She says, I haven't exercised in more than 20 years, but I want to tell you this story. She said, 20 years ago, I actually saw you in a race, but I didn't know who you were. And she says, I was running the San Francisco Marathon in 1994. She said, at about the 12-mile mark, I noticed that you were with someone running the marathon with a friend.
Is she referring to you, Luann, or to me?
No, she's referring to you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She said, your friend argued that she was tired and sore and that you kept on trying to motivate her to stay in it. And she says, I noticed that she was angry and she just didn't want to be there anymore because she was starting to hurt. And she was going to just go right towards the curb. And she says, and you actually stayed with her. She says, I was much farther back, but I noticed you stayed with her. And my friend and I were watching this whole thing. And we kind of went over and we were listening to what you were saying. And you told her to close her right eye, look at the ground, and to follow your voice. And she did. And at the 20-mile mark, they actually opened up the roads to traffic again. And we were all basically at the end there, dodging traffic with no water. She says, and there you went, directing traffic so that we could all pass. And we were tired. But I wanted to know, I mean, I was amazed when you told her, visualize that you're riding a strong horse, closing your right eye. And we all did it. And the next thing I remembered, we had just 1 mile to go. And you stayed with this woman the entire race. She says, I later came over and asked how she felt when she finished. And she was smiling and happy, and she says, I'm glad that Gary stayed with me and gave me energy. And she said, I only began to listen to your show recently. Now I see you on PBS, and I have many of your books. So her question was this. What was it that you did to your friend and the rest of us to help us finish? And now she asks, do you think that someone who is overweight with diabetes and high blood pressure on medications and antidepressants can actually get back into shape, given my age?
There is a video somewhere on YouTube that shows a group of individuals at a retreat. You'll see that they're overweight with diabetes and other conditions and with no training. Now, listen to what I'm saying, no training. They did 26 miles. We were there counting the laps. You'll see us handing them water. If you believe in something, you release an internal energy, and that's what powers you. The person in the San Francisco Marathon, just 1 week before the marathon, had never done more than 5 miles of light training. I was going out to do the marathon because I had won the Los Angeles Marathon gold, and I wanted to see if I could win the San Francisco Marathon in race walking. And so she got out there. She came, and in the race, she got very tired very quickly and wanted to stop, and I kept encouraging her. And then I was doing visualizations. And the woman is right. She was really angry. She was yelling and screaming one time, and I'm just telling her to calm down. She wanted to leave the course. I kept the focus on the visualization. At the end, she passed the other women, and she won the gold. She won a gold marathon in a major marathon and was first. You have no idea how many people she has told that story to about what it meant for her and how it changed her life. So the takeaway message is that you can't look at what you're doing today or where you've been in the past. You have to look at where you want to be. And when you want to clear that mind and free yourself from the past, then you can do almost anything with right motivation, right energy, and right perspective, and, of course, a lot of discipline. And it can make a difference. I've seen it time and time again. Thank that woman, whoever she is, for her email. And I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen today. It was nice of being able to share this hour with you. Have a nice day.